thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 49 for the 8th of December 2009. The Twubble with Twecklers. And we're here with the 49th edition of the Digital Campus podcast, quickly approaching the celebratory 50th special. What is that, the gold platinum anniversary? What is that? I can't remember which anniversary it is, but we're very excited about the next podcast, but even more excited
gold.
To be here. Is it gold? It's got to be gold, right?
Yeah, it's
gold.
Do you think we could
look that up on the internet?
Here I am sitting in front of two computer screens, and I'm the host of a podcast and haven't even taken the time to look up what the 50th anniversary is. We'll do that later in the podcast, something exciting to look forward to. Well, welcome. I'm Dan Cohen, and here with our regulars, Mills Cully. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, guys.
Hey. And we're here also with one of our new irregulars, our regular irregulars, Steve Ramsey from the University of Nebraska.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Well, let's dive right in. We didn't get a chance last time to discuss one story about Twitter that we saw in the Chronicles Wired Campus blog. And it's been a while since we've talked about Twitter. And even though one of the regulars who will go unnamed and has a fake has issues with Twitter, well, it always adds the debate, which we like here at the Digital Campus podcast. Twitter at conferences, you know, I noticed, guys, that there's already a hashtag for the American Historical Association's 2010 conference, which is in San Diego in a month in early January. And, you know, the Chronicle sometimes, you know, which takes a dark view of things online like Twitter and blogs, has this piece about Twecklers. I hate all these neologisms that involve TW for Twitter and then something else like tweeps. But Twecklers, is this a potential problem now as Twitter goes mainstream, that there will be audience members who will be tweeting nasty things about the presenters? At the same time, over the last couple of weeks, Dana Boyd, who is a fairly prominent blogger and was an academic, got a PhD in something digital, cultural anthropology and digital anthropology. She studies digital natives and now works at Microsoft Research, and was giving a talk at the Web 2.0 Expo. And I guess they had a live screen up behind her with all the tweets from the conferences and experienced the, I think, dually difficult twekling and then also, I think, some gender, you know, really gender discrimination as people started sort of talking about her as an object on Twitter rather than about the content of her talk. Is this a real problem and something that those of us who have been involved in, you know, Twitter should have been sort of glossing over or taken lightly?
Well, I mean, did anybody think that when they were giving a presentation before the advent of Twitter that people weren't talking behind their backs? I see it as, you know, it may be more public, it may be facilitated by the technology, but it seems like, you know, I think we've all gotten through a session at a conference and walked out of the room and said to our friends, "Boy, that was terrible." We've done that before. Doing it on Twitter, I see it as an evolution, not a revolution.
So the evolution is just before we said it to our friends, and now we say it to the world.
Yeah, I mean, is there something about the scale here where
everyone
tuning in?
I feel like academic conferences still retain a great deal of formal ceremony, you know, that you give your paper and then, you know, afterwards there is a set period for question and answers and, you know, the questioner stands up and says who they are and says, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a very different vibe than, you know, I can't believe she wore that skirt. You know, that, you know, coming over Twitter. I mean, I think those things are worlds apart. And I'm not sure that it's appropriate to do, it's any more appropriate to do it over Twitter than it is over, you know, to stand up and say something like that. And, you know, because I've seen this happen where and I want to be very careful here not to mention particular communities, particular conferences, or particular people. But I've certainly watched, you know, conferences, watched the Twitter feed, and seen some very prominent key member of the field tweet something absolutely devastating about a paper being given by a junior colleague. And, you know, I saw that and I thought to myself, you know, I would have been in therapy for months if someone had done that to me. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, of course, they might be thinking it. But to do it in that very public way, I can't believe that it's any more appropriate than standing up and doing it out loud. And it seems, and both of those things seem worlds away.
No, I mean, it's,
you know what I mean?
I think you're right. I think it's completely inappropriate, but I don't think, I guess the point you made, Steve, saying that, you know, academic conferences still retain a lot of formality and there are other venues, other kinds of conferences that don't. And I'm not sure we're going to see so as much of it because of that tradition of formality and respect in, you know, at the AHA, as we might at a TED talk. Those are different things. And I think you might, you know, I just don't know if it's that different. Maybe it is, and certainly a comment about someone's short skirt or their ugly tie, you know, those are harmful things, and those are things that have no place in academic conferences. But I wonder if we're going to see that in the AHA Twitter stream.
This article in the Chronicle,
Microsoft developers event.
Right. I mean, if you look carefully at, you know, they call it conference humiliation. They're tweeting behind your back, but the conferences they mention really are more along the lines of what Dana Boyd went to, the Web 2.0 Expo. I mean, they're the Higher Ed Web Association. So this is a very, you know, Twitter heavy group, but also a snarky group. I mean, and the guy that they were, is called here a virtual lynching, which seems rather harsh. But he was the, I think the president of Ruckus Network, which is a now defunct online music service for college students. So it was, you know, someone outside of academia, which I think does bring out a kind of feeding frenzy. You know, I can't imagine, let's see, these other, the other groups where they talk about Tweckling was the National Association of Science Writers. You know, I mean, it's not the MLA, it's not the AHA, and I have a hard time thinking that there'd be snarky public tweets by people at, let's say, the president's address at the AHA.
The last time the AHA was in Washington, the Washington Post ran a kind of post facto story about, you know, people during the presidential address, people that were part of the podium group having a difficult time staying awake. So, you know, the mainstream media has, you know, picked up on this. But what worries me is, I mean, it picked up on something, you know, well, Roy started talking about forever ago, which is how incredibly boring academic conferences, at least historian conferences, tend to be. And so I think this is in one way a response to that, is a way of sort of livening it up a little bit. But what worries me is that you don't have to, you know, have your sort of your real identity on display. I could set up my own anonymous Twitter account and go into the AHA and just snark away, and who's to know who I am?
Yeah, but you know, the anonymity question in Twitter is really, I mean, you could set up another account, but you'd have no followers. I mean, I guess you could use the hashtag and it would get into the mainstream. But, you know, I don't know. You know, I mean, that's true of kind of any online piece. You can go anonymous. I haven't seen it at the conferences I've been doing. Obviously, we've
I mean, first of all, I think we can all agree that, like, someone saying, like, a truly inappropriate comment is a truly inappropriate comment, no matter what, I mean, on Twitter or any, you know, boy, right. What an ugly tie is not a useful academic statement of any kind. And so I think we can all sort of agree. But it is, I wonder whether, I mean, and I should maybe, and I should step back for a minute and say, I really love this. I really love this Twitter conference thing. I think I love it. I think I really.
Why is that, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I mean, I suppose I occasionally find it information overload. You know, I occasionally have to shut it down because I just can't watch the speaker and think and watch the Twitter stream and all of this at once. And that seems to me a separate issue. But in general, I love the idea of this, of someone who's up there giving a paper, and there's just this active conversation going on while the paper's going on. And I think I like it. But I do also think that people say things, and again, we're not talking not necessarily inappropriate things. I mean, just ordinary academic criticism that, or academic, you know, statements. People say them on Twitter in a way that they would never say in the public forum. But the thing is, they are saying it in the public forum because everyone else in the field is watching that Twitter stream. Do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of like there's a sense that we can make snarkier statements because this is less public, and it's not less public.
it's sort of analogous to like our handwriting about our students posting inappropriate photographs in Facebook, isn't it? You know, I mean, we post things. We've lost some of our boundaries or some of our professional filter about what's appropriate and what's not.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's the thing about it being public is that there are consequences when it's public. I mean, if I walk out of a conference presentation and I say, you know, I elbow my friend and say, you know, that was lousy, you know, or make some unhelpful comment, it goes nowhere. If I do it in the community out in public, you know, to the community, the community can take me to task for that. If I make an unhelpful comment, my guess is in a conference like, you know, the MLA or something, people are going to take me to task. People are going to say, well, wait, what do you mean by that? Explain yourself. Or if I say something truly inappropriate, I will be shunned by the community. I think I'll lose some friends and colleagues. And so in a way, I think it shines some light on what would have been whispers are now public. And maybe it will discourage, I mean, if people are smart, it will in some ways discourage them from whispering.
Will it also discourage junior scholars from even getting into this? I mean, you know, I remember getting ready to give my first paper ever and being thoroughly terrified. And now I'm seeing even greater evidence to be terrified. I mean, now it's really, you see what I'm saying to me?
Yeah.
Because I don't think anybody would say, you know, someone can say something really devastating in a Twitter stream that I'm convinced that they just wouldn't, I mean, they wouldn't get up at the mic and say, I've been listening to your terrible talk and I've decided it's nonsense. And they just would. No one would ever say that.
Right.
No one at an American conference. Because I got to tell you, Europeans, not so much. I've been in conferences where the first person stood up and said, "Okay, that was really stupid."
Or, you know, someone would never. someone would never get up and say, you know, you're a really terrible writer. It's hard to understand what you're saying because your writing is so obscure. Like, no one would ever make that comment, you know? But you see that kind of comment in the Twitter stream all the time. I mean, it's really extraordinary. I guess what I'm worried about is that I'm aware actually that I am making a sort of knee-jerk and highly specious argument that is of the form, that is similar to everything is different over email. You know, the, you know, like somehow, I mean, the, with email, we had this thing that we went through this period where, well, we're still in this period where, you know, I mean, do you remember back in the 90s, we'd have these netiquette guides that came out that would say things.
Yes, people would get on email and just have no sense of etiquette or how to use it.
Well, but they would, but there was a flip side to that they would, you know, would say, okay, guys, email is totally, you know, email is totally different. Email is a completely different thing, and you have to be so careful because with email, it's easy to offend people. And those of us who have, you know, devoted, you know, our lives to the study of rhetoric and the written word are looking at this and going, actually, that's a property of language. Like, that's a property of written language, generally speaking. And I'm worried that I'm making the same leap here with Twitter and saying, well, you know, this is a totally different thing. This is a totally different kind of tone, a totally different kind of forum. And it may not be. It may just be, it may not be quite as sort of thunderously different as I'm portraying it. But I worry, I guess, about civility and incivility and the way incivility, you know, may affect people coming up in the field. I guess that's one of the things I worry about.
But do you think, just to be clear here, I mean, do you think that the incivility is encouraged by the technology of Twitter, let's say in the same way that we saw this happen in Usenet or some other environments that have been online in the last two decades? Or is it that people really haven't learned how to use it correctly right now? You know, Dana Boyd makes this point on her blog, and we'll link to this post from digitalcampus.tv, that... you know, I think the Twitter back channel is perfectly reasonable when the speaker is trying to entertain, but when the goal is to convey something with depth that encourages people to be impatient and frustrated and to feed on the speaker. Is that just endemic to the technology?
Well, I guess what I was trying very awkwardly to say a moment ago is that I'm always a little suspicious of arguments that say the technology changes the whole thing completely. You know, even though, you know, there's some truth to that. I mean, people who if people would not get up to the microphone and say things that are uncivil, but would over Twitter, then I think we can conclude that the technology is playing a role here in the filter. So I think that's on the one hand a legitimate argument, but I also want to turn around and say, just because you're on Twitter, or just because you're in AIM or just because you're on Skype does not mean that the normal rules of civil discourse that we all implicitly agree to by being members of this discipline and this endeavor, those don't all go out the window because you're on Twitter.
I just come down on the side of, you know, is this really happening? Like, and I, at least in my experience, I don't see all kinds of nastiness at the conferences I attend going on. I mean, occasionally there are unhelpful comments, and that you know is what it is. But I think on balance, for me, the Twitter stream is a net benefit, and is you know on the whole tends to be very positive rather than negative. That's where I come down. I mean, you know, and this issue of whether the technology changes everything, you know, I think about, like, you know, there's a story from a couple of years ago where the mother and the daughter forced the suicide of a classmate by, you know, saying nasty things on MySpace. You know, and that's awful, and everybody blamed MySpace for, you know, in addition to the mother and the daughter, but everybody blaming MySpace for this poor girl's death. And it seemed to me the whole time that I was thinking, like, you know, if you're that much of a jerk that you're going to cause some, if you're going to be so nasty that you're going to cause somebody to commit suicide, you're going to find a way to do it whether you have MySpace or not. And so I just, you know, Steve, I take the point that, like, I just don't know if the technology changes all that much. I think, you know, if you're people who want to be jerks, people who want to be jerks in writing are going to be jerks in writing, and you know the Twitter may make it slightly easier, but they're still jerks.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to interpret it as causal. You know, like, people are. I mean, I agree with you absolutely that you don't want to think of this as a causal phenomenon. Like, people are jerks because of Twitter. People are jerks because of the way the technology is set up. I mean, I don't think that's true either.
No, but I think that there is something still to the kind of the perceived anonymity, even though your name is on your Twitter feed or your name is on a comment that you post on a blog or whatever it is, there's still this sort of you're sitting in front of your computer by yourself and you smack your index finger down on the enter key and say, aha, so there. Because I have to say, I'm going to disagree with Tom on this, because it happens all the time in teaching, and that is that students in a class who in the classroom, in any other sort of formal environment like that, would never say kind of really off-base things to other students, will post comments in a blog or back in the day go on a threaded discussion that, you read them and you just think, whoa, where did that come from? And lots of students, what we're really talking here is a 21st or Web 2.0 version of a flame war. Remember that term from the past. And students who are sort of mild-mannered and otherwise, and all of a sudden this just rage or inappropriate stuff comes out in an online comment. And so I think something does happen for some subset of the general population, that when it's just them at the computer and they can type something and post it, they will. It's like some sort of filter gets removed in that kind of the one-on-one interaction between them and what they're looking at on their screen, as opposed to the one-on-one interaction or the group interaction between them and real live people. So that I do worry about this a little bit. My biggest concern on this issue has everything to do with the job market, because faculty members who have tenure are completely insulated in many ways from the consequences of people snarking about them. Okay, people want to snark about my conference stuff, I'm fine. That, I can live with that. I'll be probably very unhappy or angry or offended or whatever, but especially if they comment on my ties, which I'm very proud of because they're so tacky. But I put a lot of thought into these tacky ties. But the
I've been meaning to tweet that, Mills. Yeah, I've been meaning to tweet about your ties.
Tweet away. wait till the holiday party, then you'll really see tacky. But all of us, I think, need to reaccess the paranoia of the almost finished or just finished PhD in a bad job market, where even the slightest imperfection feels like, a giant wound that's going to prevent them from getting a job. And whether that's true or not, it's a whole different story, but it feels that way. And so, I can just imagine somebody who's just finished their PhD, they go to the AHA, they give a paper, they know that members of search committees who they're interviewing with are there in the audience, and then somebody, posts this snarky tweet about, I can't believe this guy can't translate from German to English properly, and some member of the search committee might read that. Well, search committees probably don't pay close attention to these things, but just reaccess the paranoia that you felt or that your friends felt when they were going on the job market. So
we should mention though that I have exactly the same worry, but we should mention that there's a possible flip side to this too, and that is just as you can have an eminent, extremely tenured leader of the field in the back row kibitzing away over Twitter, and just feeling perfectly at liberty to, harumph about everything, and feels completely protected and immune from prosecution. At the same time, you can also have someone who's very new to the field, is slightly, intimidated by all of this, who can put a comment into the Twitter feed and have that heard and all around the world.
I've discovered, people in digital humanities is often through those methods. Yeah.
I think of all of the people on all the graduate students on Twitter who are, new to the field, and I watch their Twitter feeds and was I this smart? And I concluded, no, I don't think I was. I think they're just, they're just this sort of, they're in this, they're in this place with their dissertation work or whatever it might be, and they just have one insight after another. They're connected to the literature in a way that's just astounding. And now I, who am closer to harumphing in the back row than giving my first paper, know who all these people are, and that's good. That's good for them, I think.
You know, I recently put together...
I would not have had a way as a graduate student to be friends with me before Twitter. And like, I'm That's friends right. with tons of graduate students through Twitter. And that is, I think, again, when I say it's sort of, you know, it's a net positive, I think that's where exactly, Steve, where I'm coming from.
And I actually don't. And it's funny how, since they're not my graduate students and they're not at my institution, let me be clear. Some of them are, but a lot of the graduate students I know on Twitter are, I only know them through Twitter. I only know them through this venue. And so a lot of the sort of power dynamic of having graduate students as students that you're working with and trying to bring up in the field, you're more likely to view these graduate students on Twitter as just peers, just other intellectuals out there. Which I think can be very empowering, you know, for them and very useful for me, you know. So it's another example where the technology in a way is very usefully it levels the field a bit in the Twitter stream, I don't sit there and think to myself, well, that comment was just made by a graduate student. What could this person possibly know? I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I mean,
you wouldn't say that, you know. You just you think, wow, that's incredibly smart. And like I said, I usually think, I wonder if I was that smart when I was a graduate student. And I think to myself, no, I probably was not.
You know, I made the same argument a few years ago about one of the things I like about Google Reader is that it turns all writing into the same font and, you know, in a non-hierarchical list of blogs and feeds. And, you know, it is how I found up-and-coming stars in digital humanities is, you know, I just subscribe to their blogs and I don't think about the fact that they're grad students or early grad students versus tenured faculty. And I think right now, I created this Twitter list when Twitter list came out about a month ago of everyone in digital humanities. And to be honest, I can't think of right now a more comprehensive list. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I'm trying to think of where else would I go to find 354 people, which is what I've got right now, who are in digital humanities. It's hard for me to imagine where I could find those people, especially since they're in literature, they're in history, they're in museums and libraries, they're funders, they're institutions. I'm not sure that it'd be easy to find it, especially in a kind of non-hierarchical sense or non-balkanized sense that you get on Twitter. Well, we might have to move on here. Looking at these articles about these Twecklers, I also wonder if part of the problem here is that they have these giant 20-foot screens behind the speakers. I mean, you talk about the Mills's point about that certain percentage that will go AWOL on Twitter, I wonder if they're encouraged a little bit by the fact that they know that their tweet will show up in foot-high font behind the speaker as this goes along.
I do. We should probably just mention, it would be good to hear from some graduate students in the comment thread on this podcast about what their perspective on this.
If yeah,
this
great is idea.
Ringing true
yeah,
for them.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Or if we're just projecting onto them and,
right.
and misremembering our own experience as graduate students or something.
Yeah, and this topic came up a little bit because some of us received a message from some researchers at University College London who are doing a study of Twitter at academic conferences, true academic conferences, not these Web 2.0-y sorts of technology conferences. And I'm interested to see the results of that as well and how people felt about it. That'll be interesting to follow up. Well, Mills, we'll put you out of your suffering and move on from Twitter. I know you'd like us to do the whole podcast on Twitter, but we will move on.
And I was feeling a little lonely there because I guess I'm not one of those 354 people.
Well, you are in your alter ego.
Oh, okay.
At Ed Wired, the fake Mills Mills on Twitter, at Ed Wired. Well, at some point you'll have the real one. I know. 2010, New Year's coming up. Well, let's move on to just a cluster of stories that caught our eye from the past couple of weeks that I guess summarizes some areas that we've talked about on the podcast over the past year that Google has been working on that I guess we could say is generally grouped into the title of Google and Speed. Over the past couple of weeks, you know, we've seen a preview of their new Chrome operating system, which is different for some reason than their Chrome browser, but is a kind of always on the internet operating system that will run on new laptops and connect always to the cloud and be very speedy. In fact, they require a solid state drive. So one suspects that this will be a very speedy operating system, though limited in many ways, of course. Can't operate it if you're not connected to Wi-Fi. But they've done a lot of smaller things as well. They have just yesterday launched the Google DNS, which is a new domain name server that you connect to translate domains like dancohen.org into the IP address that it needs to reach to talk to a server and get my website. They have a new protocol called Speedy, or I think it's pronounced Speedy. It's S-P-D-Y, which tries to speed up the communications between servers and clients so that web page load faster. So they're altering the venerable HTTP protocols behind every website and trying to encourage people to adopt that. And they also came out with a new, interestingly, not a scripting language, but a real kind of root hardcore coding language that would compete with something like C or C++ called Google Go. And also Eric Schmidt talked a little bit about their obsession with speed in a Wall Street Journal op-ed this week, which was a kind of counterattack against Rupert Murdoch and his obsession with Google as stealing their news. And part of Eric Schmidt's point was that you know, newspapers online are a terrible experience right now. You're clicking on pages that take 10 seconds to load, and there's a speed issue, there's a display issue, and that he talked about, I guess they have this pilot called Flex, which presents a new sort of viewing environment for newspapers and magazines. I think we might have talked about this a few months ago, but a kind of glossier and very fast-loading environment, sort of like a Flash environment that Google's experimenting with for their print materials. What do the three of you think is going on here? Is this obsession with speed something important? Is that such a serious issue that it would take prominence over, you know, other issues of displaying robust content online? Mills, what did you think of this, these set of developments?
Well, I, for one, would certainly welcome a little more speed, especially with newspapers, because I do find it incredibly frustrating. What I'm not clear about, and just because some of this now moves into technical domains that are beyond me, but I mean, is Google really? Do we think that Google's really trying to set up a whole alternative? Not an alternative internet, because the internet's more than just the protocols, but sort of an alternative piece of the internet. And this sort of goes back to the conversation we had in the last podcast about the balkanization of the web, with, you know, News Corp trying to isolate their content just to Bing. And, you know, I think one analogy to this is what happened with Walmart and the little scan codes, the barcodes. You know, when barcoding first came out, retailers resisted it a lot because they didn't want to go back and fix their packaging to have barcodes on it. And Walmart, because of its domination of the retail market, was able to say, if you want your product in our store, it's going to have a barcode on it. And so retailers then went and used the barcodes. Is Google's position on the internet big enough that they could say something like that? You know, you're going to start using our protocols rather than these, as you say, venerable protocols that we've been living with all these years. So I think that's really the interesting question, is which direction is this going?
You know, pieces of this make a lot of sense. I mean, especially I think for an academic market where, you know, we're less interested in advertising and you know, flashy content. For instance, the Speedy protocol allows you to specify what loads first on the page. So if you look at the way a web page loads, it's, you know, it's often just slapdash. You know, sometimes a big logo shows up first, even on our, you know, even on non-commercial websites, museum or library websites. You could actually specify, if your server is using the Speedy protocol, you can say, hey, show the, let's say, the primary document first, and then show me all the navigation, etc., the logo for our museum or library archive second or third. That seems pretty nice, doesn't it? I mean, isn't there something to this?
I really think that Google's formula here is actually really easy to understand, and it's just that they're an advertising company. You know, what they sell is ads, and they sell ads on the web, and their plan for world domination is going really well in that, you know, in terms of dominating that field. And what's essential to their domination is the idea that there are lots and lots of eyes on the web. And it's all about the more people who are looking at web browsers, the more they can assure their advertisers that their advertising model is working. And I think everything they do can be instantly and easily related to that goal. It's like, why move into the mobile phone business? Well, because you would like the mobile phone business to be about looking at the web on the phone. You know, why move into, why develop a new browser with this incredibly fast JavaScript engine? And the answer is because, you know, you would like people to be using applications on the web. You see what I mean? Like, let's get everybody on the web.
Right.
And of course,
right,
we look at this and we go, wait, isn't everybody on the web? But I think from Google's standpoint, no, not enough. We would like everybody on the web all the time. And so, you know, so they get into things like, so in a sense, I think they step back and they say, in what way does the web suck? Well, it's a little slow. And it's a little clunky over here, and it's clunky over there, and it's difficult to use it in this environment. It's difficult to use it on this device, and they make a list and they knock them down one after the other. so now we as humanists are interested in the web. For us, it strikes me we're interested in the web for a slightly different reason. You know, we're interested in it because we have a diverse community with a lot of different our community has lots of different platforms and lots of different technological situations and all kinds of things, and it's easier for us to deliver our content and our tools and all of that sort of stuff to that audience over the web than it is to do application development for individual platforms and so forth. And so in a way, you know, we benefit, I suppose, from all of this, all of Google's obsessions, but we're not exactly after the same goal, are we? Right? Like we don't have exactly the same idea that Google has.
Right. I mean, aren't we more on the side of, I mean, I shudder to think of this, of Rupert Murdoch and saying, well, content is king. You know, good content, you know, it matters more than web design or
right. and
speed
I think,
of loading.
And I think Google says, oh, is it content? We don't actually care what it is. We just want to figure out. I mean, like, I think when you say content is king, you're making a statement about how the world is, but you're also making a statement about how you think the world should be. And I think Google doesn't care what is drawing people to the web, except insofar as it relates to the question, what will get them looking at browsers?
Right.
And that's not the same thing. When we say content is king, we don't say that because we're trying to find out what is king so we can get as many people looking at our ads as possible. We say content is king because we believe in content. We believe that is actually, you know, sustains human culture and so forth. So we're not after the same thing. It seems to me.
I think that's that idea that content is maybe not king, and that they don't, not really caring about what the content is, extends to the Google engineers. And I think to some extent, all of these developments, and we, you know, we talk about Google a lot because it seems like every week they're coming up with something new. And I think some of that has to do with the way Google is managed, in that, you know, they give these brilliant engineers 20% time. They give them 8 hours a week to work on whatever they want. And, you know, and that is not exactly true of all of the people at Google, but a lot of them are spending 8 hours a week, plus probably a lot of their spare time, you know, looking at things like, you know what, I don't like the way HTTP works, you know, and like they know HTTP, the innards of the protocol intimately, and they say, you know what, I could make this better. And so they go off and they make it better. And then, you know, Google posts Speedy to the web and says, here, we've got a better HTTP. You know, so to some extent, it's just it's letting engineers loose on the web, and they come up with a bunch of these things, and it is in the end, I think it's kind of schizophrenic, and some of these things I think we have to say won't go anywhere. You know, I think right. It's difficult to predict which ones will stick and which ones won't, but I would guess the majority of them will kind of fall by the wayside as, you know, good ideas, nice little experiments, but nothing that's going to be actually commercialized and widely adopted.
Their vision of Chrome OS and all of these related technologies to make the web function well is pretty similar to what we've discussed on the podcast in terms of campus applications like a tablet or mobile unit that basically operates as a single application. A web browser application that feels like a device. And they're trying to get to that, right? I mean, they're trying to say on Chrome OS, sort of the browser becomes your entire desktop. And it's just got a bunch of tabs. And so you could imagine very easily a bunch of cheap Chrome OS devices. I don't want to call them laptops because I assume they'll come in all shapes and sizes, but you know, that you could use for, you know, as clickers, let's say in classroom or to beam out video. It just, again, gets to, I think, a lot of where, you know, their other efforts, like their mobile effort, Android, is going toward, and the iPhone and all these new devices. I mean, they just want it to be always on and snappy and to feel like a device, but to use web, you know, standard web protocols, right?
Well, it's sort of to say, you know, I would like to, if I did all my word processing on the web, then I would be staring at the web more often, and that would be good for Google. And I don't do that because, well, I mean, it's not quite, you know, you can't really build a serious application on a serious word processor on the web. And Google looks at that and says, well, what if we gave you a new system programming language? And what if we gave you, always on ubiquity? And what if we gave you, this massive widget set that was incredibly responsive and easy to work with? And what if the JavaScript engine ran like an assembler? I mean, you know, they go on and on like this. And then, you know, the goal here is that I look at the web. You know, it's like all of this, it seems to me, is focused on how do we break down people's strange and inexplicable unwillingness to do absolutely everything in their browser window. I mean, that seems to be what it's all about. You know, and it's funny, I guess, you know, I think it was Mills, you were just saying, you began this by saying, you know, are they creating a kind of alternate web? And I don't know, and I think they would disavow that and, you know, make all kinds of noises about how they have no plan like that at all. But it's interesting that when you look at the protocols of the web, like HTTP or DNS or any of these things, I mean, if you're an engineer and you look at these things, you're immediately struck by how stupid they are. I mean, you say, could I use my 8 hours on Friday to develop a better DNS? And you know, the answer is actually you could use your train ride in to think of that because it's not hard to get a better HTTP. I mean, HTTP is not a, you know, you could on the back of an envelope design a better, protocol, but that would ignore the fact that the stupidity of the protocol, the simplicity of the protocol, and all of that is one of the reasons we have the web in the first place. And so you wouldn't want that if what they're up to is let's make everything better. And sacrifice that simplicity and all of that other stuff, that could have a deleterious effect.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. I'm sure we're going to follow some of these threads, certainly the Chrome OS and what happens with that on various platforms in 2010. But let's move on to our picks of the week. Mm-hmm. And it is, in fact, time for Picks of the Week. Boy, we haven't had them in a couple of months as we've experimented with our new irregular format, but we've had some requests to bring them back, and we've duly noted that. So let's start with you, Mills. What do you have for your Pick of the Week?
Well, as I suspect the oldest member of the podcast, I'm going back to the past instead of back to the future, and there's a Firefox add-on that brings back Gopher. And of course, many of you listening to the podcast will have no clue what we're talking about here, but but the rest of us oldsters out here are old enough to remember the good old days when Gopher was how you surfed the web. And so Gopher, the University of Minnesota, has long since shut down their Gopher server, but something called the Overbyte project from FloodGap Systems has brought Gopher back. So if you just want the cleanest and most boring way to browse the web, you can download this extension to Firefox and go back to Gopher.
Do you want to explain the Gopher interface for those who don't remember it?
I mean, it is truly just some text on a screen, and that's it. There are no image possibilities. Like, if you're sick of all those slow-loading images, or you don't want video popping up on your screen, or any kind of pop-up browsing opportunities, pop-up windows, any of that, just go with Gopher, because it's just going to give you it's like the Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, approach to web browsing, just the text.
Right. And it really was an alternate universe.
And if I remember, it's all menus based, right?
Right.
It's
right.
It conceives of the internet as there is stuff out there, and you go get it. That's it. There's no dazzle, you know.
no idea of interaction or anything This is web, not even this is web 0.3.
Right. A series of folders. I remember my Gopher client just was a series of folders, and you'd click in the folder and folders within folders and folders linking to other folders. It's beautiful. Okay, well, we'll put on our our Journey CDs and fire up that extension. Thanks, Mills, for for the addition. Tom, what do you have for us this time?
I've got a print book, but it's also a free download on the web called The Art of Community by John O'Bacon. John O'Bacon is the Ubuntu community manager, and this is a book that I'm not quite finished with, but it gives a good roadmap, really, for anyone who wants to manage a community project. In his case, he manages an open source software project, but it could be applied to someone who is running building a collaborative website or group teaching a class. It provides a lot of good information, good tips for how you engage dispersed community of contributors and volunteers and collaborators. And I think it's something that, we in digital humanities do every day and strive to do better. And I think this book can help people with some ideas in that effort.
Great. And that's a free download online?
Yeah, you can order it. I mean, it's a print book from O'Reilly, so you can buy it from Amazon. But it's also a free download at theartofcommunityonline.org.
Great. We'll link to that in our show notes as well. Steve, what do you have for us from Nebraska?
Well, those of us who remember Gopher, and I definitely remember Gopher, also remember the blink tag.
The blink tag.
That has become a kind of proverb for horrible, irritating, stress-inducing web design.
And people still use it.
Well, I think people still use it on most web pages, because most web pages, it seems to me, are blinking and flipping out. And I mean, you go to the New York Times, and it's like you've walked into Times Square. There's all these things blinking and flipping out and all of this sort of stuff. And into this cacophony, which does nothing but cause me pain and distress, comes Readability, this marvelous little tool from Arc90 Laboratory. And this group of developers, we can give some more information about it on the website. But basically what you do, and it's not a plugin and it's nothing fancy like that, you go to a website like the New York Times, and you're looking at that website, you click this button on your, you click the button for readability, and this will put this up on the screen like you're looking at a book. It will remove all of the blinking ads and all of the 9-point font and all of that kind of stuff. It will just present it to you as a single column. You have a few choices in how you represent that web page, but as clear and as uncluttered as possible. It also, I like it because it I do not think that it because you have to. You go to the website and then you represent the information. It doesn't compromise, in my opinion, the ad revenue that is likely sustaining that site in a lot of cases, because I think that it's just when you settle down to read the article, you just click this button and it will reformat it so that you don't have all this distraction out of the corner of your eye.
Yeah, this is great. I've used this before and it really, really helps you out. I mean, this is a case where you know, I think much like what Google's doing, there's someone really thinking about a specific use case. And in this case, I think for deep reading, this really helps. Your eye is distracted.
I mean, the other great thing about readability, and I use it almost daily, is it gives you a print style sheet as well. So if you want to print out the article, it has a great print style sheet.
I didn't realize that. Huh. Even better. Great. Okay, well, my pick of the week is a little self-serving. It is another Zotero pick. I try to keep them to one a year, so I feel like 2009 is almost over. And I just want to let everyone know that Zotero Cloud Storage is here. We have been offering up to 100 megabytes for free, on a cost recovery basis, we've now made available up to 10 gigs. That people can purchase from within their Zotero account. So if you're a user of the Zotero research tool, you can now go to your settings and look under storage, and there's the possibility there of getting additional storage. The neat thing about this storage is that it can be attached to groups. So it's not just for personal backup and synchronization across multiple machines, if you have multiple machines, but it also allows you to put up to 10 gigs on a group. So if we have a group, let's say for Digital Campus, and we wanted to put files there, which we can do now. I'm going to go ahead and attach my storage. I bought 10 gigs, and yes, I do pay for it, even though I'm part of the project. And we can now put files into the Digital Campus folder, or collection, as we like to call it. And those files will automatically, in real time, sync out to everyone in the group. So it's a really nice way of adding, again, more collaborative features, this time with files, and you can have files up to 4 gigs, although I have no idea what would happen if you started putting a lot of 4 gig files in there. But it's a nice way to have those files, like PDFs. You could even do MP3s, any research that you have, you could put in a file and share it with other people in your group. Again, that's Zotero Storage, and we'll have a direct link to our frequently asked questions page, as I'm sure a lot of our audience has questions about this, on Digital Campus TV blog. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, as always.
Good to have you on here on an irregular basis. And Mills and Tom, looking forward to the big 50th next time on Digital Campus.
We have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for